I'm delighted to introduce Amy Liu, who is the Deputy Director and co-founder of the Metropolitan Policy Program at the Brookings Institution. The program produces trend analysis, research, and policy ideas that advance the health and prosperity of cities and metropolitan areas. The program focuses on the role of federal, state, and local policies in partnership with the private sector to achieve prosperity in these communities. Ms. Liu is a frequent speaker to national, state, and local elected business and nonprofit leaders on reforms that advance the competitiveness of metro areas. These include the intersected policies leveraging innovation, infrastructure, human capital, and quality spaces. Ms. Liu also serves as a co-author of select Brookings publications, including Moving Beyond Sprawl Toward a Broader Metropolitan Agenda, which appeared in the Brookings Review. She was the principal author of A Region Divided, The State of Growth in Greater Washington, D.C. She has also been a frequent speaker and commentator on the rebuilding efforts in New Orleans and southern Louisiana post-Hurricanes Katrina and Rita. She is the co-author of the frequently cited The New Orleans Index, Tracking Recovery of New Orleans and the Metro Area. She has authored several other papers related to the post-disaster rebuilding effort, including Building a Better New Orleans, A Review and Plan for Progress 1 Year After Katrina, and Housing Families Displaced by Katrina, A Review of the Federal Response to Date. For Brookings Opportunity 08 Initiative, Ms. Liu wrote Pathways to the Middle Class, Ensuring Greater Upward Mobility for All Americans with Hugh Price, which puts forth ideas on how best to help working families achieve and maintain the American dream of middle class prosperity. Prior to Brookings, Ms. Liu was Special Assistant to Secretary Henry Cisneros at the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, where she served as the principal aide on a number of public housing and other reform efforts. Ms. Liu has also worked for the U.S. Senate Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee and the Metropolitan Planning Council in Chicago. Amy Liu currently serves on the advisory board of the Alexandria Community Trust, a community foundation in Northern Virginia, and on the board of the Hopkins House, a preschool and comprehensive education center that serves low and moderate income children and families. Please help me in welcoming Amy Liu.
Hello. I apologize for getting here late. I had a couple of travel delays and mishaps today getting here. I'm sure it's something that many of you probably have experienced trying to get to Cornell, but I'm really happy to be here with you today. Use the mouse, right? Make sure it's all on there. Great. How many people here are familiar with the work we do at Brookings on cities and metro areas? Oh, quite a few of you. Great. Well, I was going to talk to you about the urban agenda today. An extent to which the Obama administration's focusing on that. Oh, is there a way where it, where I move it?
So it's a VLC file, which means it just plays by itself. If
there isn't, it's not a movie where I click through it in movie time. In QuickTime.
Is anybody familiar with this program?
Is it open? And it's all you know what you can do.
Is it? Here's the mouse.
Sorry. Is where's the where the file is saved?
Right there.
Sorry. What? No, I know. So I'm supposed to open this in QuickTime.
Okay, so you might be able to just draw the file into the QuickTime.
Is this it right here?
Application. Yes, that's it.
Ah. I think that should do it. Is this in the screen? Oh, that's not. Oh, sorry. I am not the most.
Do you have it saved as a different type of document?
I think this is the way it views, right? There it goes. There we go. Great. I think we're set. I'm just going to jump right into this. I get a lot of calls from reporters asking me how the extent to which President Obama, who has been deemed by many people as the first real urban president our country has seen in a long time, they ask me the extent to which he has been really an urban president. Has he advanced policies that really have been helpful to cities and metropolitan areas? And I think to answer that question, and what I spend most of my time oftentimes with reporters, I spend a lot of time just answering for them, what is urban policy? Because then we can then decide whether the president has been a good urban president. And I think it's really interesting is in the 12 years or so that I've been at Brookings at this program, we have probably at this point would deem that our job is to retire that phrase, urban policy. And that is primarily because in the old days, the phrase urban policy has become synonymous with anti-poverty programs, housing programs, the empowerment zones, urban renewal, and efforts that are really concretely focused on distressed neighborhoods or low-income people. And that's not to say that those are not important issues, but I think we are at a period where we need to get beyond that. And that means having an urban agenda that goes from a focus on deficits to a focus on assets. I realize my mic's not on. One that moves from, is this mic off then? Okay, great. One that moves from a focus on just urban neighborhoods to thinking about all the different geographies within a metropolitan area and the metropolitan area as a whole, whether we're working in an urban neighborhood, at a city level, an older suburban level, an outer county that's experiencing a lot of growth, or again, like the metro area as a whole. We need to get beyond the urban neighborhood focus and think broadly. And more importantly, we need to move away from just focusing on poverty alleviation, which again is really important, but to a broader set of goals around opportunity, around economic prosperity, and around sustainability. And I used to work for Henry Cisneros, and I was at a meeting that we all had when the White House Urban Office had their sort of coming out party. And in that meeting, Henry Cisneros, who's a former HUD secretary under Clinton, basically said, we lose if urban policy is treated like welfare reform. That urban policy becomes a separate issue that the federal government deals with. Because at the end of the day, urban policy is about how all parts of domestic policy, whether it's around healthcare, job creation, environmental sustainability, is all delivered through the lens, bottoms up, of cities and metropolitan areas. And that's what I'm talking about that we need to get to. And so this is our fundamental premise, and which is what where I'm going to start to move through this presentation, is that we believe that metropolitan areas are essentially the engines of national prosperity. And that, you know, if we're going to have that urban policy now, it's really interesting because some folks have said to us, what are you saying about urban policy? And what we're saying is urban policy today is really about national policy delivered through cities and metropolitan areas. That the way for us to achieve the national objectives laid out by the president, particularly during these really tough economic times, is we have to embrace where our economy and where opportunities fundamentally concentrated. And this is particularly important now because of the economic crisis that we're in. And the reason we focus on metropolitan areas first and foremost is because they are the economic units of not only the economy, but the global economy. As Michael Porter, who's a business professor over at Harvard, has often said to us, there is no U.S. economy. There's only a network of highly diverse and highly interdependent metropolitan economies that compete with other metropolitan economies around the world. And this is our national economy. So what I'm going to do today is talk about this new vision of an urban agenda and how the president is responding. So let me walk through 4 points. And the first is we have to situate ourselves first about what are the major challenges facing our country today. And there's no doubt that this nation is facing a whole series of crises. Many of these you know. First of all, we know that job losses are now slowing, but really remaining very severe. And if you take a look at this graphic, we know that the recession started at the end of December 2007. And look at all that extreme job loss we have experienced over the last, since that period. We've lost almost 4 million jobs since December 2007. More recent uptick in job growth that we've heard everyone report recently, but at the end of the day, not at all close to making up those 4 million jobs lost. At the same time, unemployment remains really high, which is one thing that Larry Summers and everybody else is really focused on. We're at 9.7% unemployment. That's basically has remained stagnant over the last period of several months. And obviously, everyone knows we now have a record high number of people who are experiencing long-term unemployment of over 6 months or longer. And then obviously, at the center of the whole economic crisis started as a housing crisis, and our foreclosure situation has not improved at all. We still, over the last 3 months, are seeing 900,000 additional foreclosures added to our housing portfolio. And we know that this economic crisis is really being felt by low-income people and really exacerbating a lot of the challenge. Actually, we have wiped out all the gains we made in terms of helping people move out of poverty. In the last 8 years, we have added 4 million people, or 8 million people too, who are now considered low income. Our poverty rate in the last 10 years have grown from 12.4% of the population to now 13.2% of the population. And there's obviously a lot of talk about the need to shift to a green economy. And part of the reason for this is that it is a real source for job creation. And the desire to create more diverse products and alternative energy is partly driven by our a desire to not focus on or depend on foreign oil. And what's really interesting about this number is right now this chart shows that in the last 50 years or so, our dependence on foreign oil has basically, you know, more than quadrupled. 70% of our oil supply comes from other countries. And at a time when the president is trying to close our trade deficit and double our exports over the next 5 years, the importance of increasing our own ability to supply our own energy sources is really becoming more paramount. So how are we going to address all those challenges? And what we make the case for is at this moment, metropolitan areas basically hold the assets and the key to addressing all these issues. And when we launched an effort about right before the election, we looked at all the economic literature. And we tried to find out what really matters to boosting, moving the dial on economic productivity, on moving the dial on income growth, and moving the dial on reducing our carbon footprint. And all the literature came back and said there are only four things that really matter: innovation, human capital, infrastructure, and quality places. Obviously, these are the sort of the pillars of what you find most local, regional, civic chambers and governors really focusing on, is how do we leverage these assets to move those big dials at the national, state, and local level. And obviously, when we talk about innovation, it's about how we create new products, new services that we can actually purchase and ship abroad and be the leader of that, not just manufacturing them. Human capital to deliver on that innovative promise. Infrastructure, not just roads and transit, but really the freight to move all of our goods in an increasing trade economy. And quality places, what we're finding out more and more is that highly skilled, highly educated workers tend to migrate to those places that really provide dense, happening, really high quality life. And so where do all these assets reside? And if you take a look at the top 100 largest metropolitan areas in the country, and there are 363 metropolitan areas, but we tend to focus on the 100 largest. But if you take a look at the 100 largest, they may represent just 12%, they may just sit on 12% of the land area and are home to 65% of the population. But they basically hold the bulk of all the assets in our economy. And so, for instance, on innovation, 78% of all patenting, which is an indicator of our ability to create new products, is generated by our metropolitan areas. 75% of all of our talent, graduated skilled workers, live in our metropolitan areas. When we think about transportation and infrastructure and the fact that we are becoming much more of a trade and global economy, 80% of all the freight movement in the country being handled, moved through our metropolitan areas, air, ports, and so forth. And then when we think about quality of life, we tend to look at transit as one of the most important indicators or assets that a city has that really tends to attract skilled workers and skilled and high innovation companies. And again, 95% of our transit miles located in our urban centers. And thanks to these assets, the top 100 metropolitan areas generally generate 75% of our nation's GDP. 75%. And that is why we say that this is where the economy ultimately resides. And this is not, even though Thomas Friedman talks about the world is getting flat, the reality is we're actually getting more spiky. And that is because over the last 50 years, these metropolitan areas are continuing to capture more and more and more of the wealth and the economic assets of our economy. And, you know, what's interesting is when people ask me, what's a metropolitan area, I have to remind them that most of us live in one. This is not a big urban agenda, anti-rural agenda at all. So let's take a look at New York. There are 12 metropolitan areas in this state, and you can see them all listed here, including Ithaca, Elmira, which I was just in, flew into, Utica, and so forth. And these 12 metropolitan areas, even though they may be 92% of the state population, they generate 95% of the state's income. And there's still lots of parts of the states that are considered white and considered rural, but at the end of the day, these are the economic engines of the state. And in fact, 47 of our 50 states are majority metropolitan today. And, you know, and it's oftentimes people say, you know, what about rural areas? And the thing is, metropolitan areas are defined by their economic geography. It's not a jurisdictional thing. It's not about population density. And the reality is, over half of rural residents actually live inside a metropolitan area. So this is not about urban versus rural. This is about whether we are giving tools to the economic engines of our economy. And I just wanted to put this up here because a lot of folks, again, think that metropolitan areas must be about Chicago, New York, and all these big city places. And the reality is Madison, Wisconsin, Omaha, Wichita, Lancaster, Pennsylvania is one of the 100 largest metropolitan areas of the country. I know people think it's Amish, it's a rural economy, but it still is, even though it may be agriculture-based or ecotourism-based, at the end of the day, it's still one of the biggest economic drivers in our country. So if that's our economic engines and the ticket to economic transformation and economic success coming out of the recession, what do we need in terms of urban policy? And what we call for is a new partnership between federal government and metropolitan areas to address all of these national ambitions that we're trying to get to. And so what's interesting is, what is the role of Washington? And I always love these two magazine covers, because the one on your left was put out on the cover of Time magazine a year right before the 2008 presidential election. And this was when there was enormous skepticism about Washington, because frankly, in the previous 8 years, there was really no focus on domestic policy. And so you have here a very happy governor and mayor basically saying, who needs Washington? I can just handle all these issues on our own. And I know that during the fiscal crisis, that smile on Schwarzenegger's face is probably not so big anymore. But what's happening is, ever since 2008 and ever since the recession, the conversation has completely changed. And we now have the Economist cover that talked about how the feds have to bail out banks, have to bail out the auto industry, have to help a stimulus package and help us get out of the immediate economic crisis. And obviously what we're hearing now is a backlash against too much Washington. And what we're arguing for is we do need to bring that dial back. We have to balance what we call more balanced federalism. And if we need a good federal policy, what we have to understand is at the end of the day, Washington doesn't build a single home, it doesn't train a single worker, it doesn't pave a single car or pave a single road. And that we, most of what people in Washington have to understand is that policies are really about how we empower the delivery system of states, localities, nonprofits, philanthropic leaders to work together in advance of national objectives. So if we're going to empower all these folks in our metropolitan areas to do this, what do we have to recognize? The reality is that there are a lot of really innovative cities and metropolitan areas that are trying to grapple with economic transformation, as we know, doing really interesting things. But at the end of the day, they too can't do it alone. They can't do it by themselves. And frankly, a lot of these issues transcend their own political boundaries. We know that a single jurisdiction cannot reinvent their economy by themselves, given the kind of the context of the larger economy. And so these are a lot of things that a lot of our localities and metro areas are trying to grapple with. So what does it mean if we were going to empower metropolitan areas to really be the solutions or the deliverer of national objectives and national goals and ambitions? And what we call for is that we need, you know, a much more accountable, strategic, and dependable partner out of our federal government. And, you know, historically, that's not what we've had at all. And this comes down to what we say is our criticism about federal policy as it relates to urban areas. And let me walk this through, because this becomes the basis of evaluating how this current or new Obama administration and Congress are working for cities and metros. One is federal policies do a really horrible job keeping pace with how much our cities and metropolitan areas have changed. And what we mean by that is that, for instance, the majority of poor people today live in the suburbs. I think people probably here know that. Since 2006, the majority of poor people today live in the suburbs. In fact, in the most recent census, the pace of growth of poverty is faster in the suburbs today than in the urban core. And yet we still deliver all of our low-income programs to cities and not to where, you know, low-income populations and the challenges are today. The other is they don't understand how economic growth happens. And when we talk to business leaders, chambers, political leaders about economic development and growing industries, what we know is every state, every metropolitan area tries to track or identify its key job sectors. What are the industry strengths that we have? And what are the key industry clusters we need to nurture and grow? And whether it's plastics, agriculture, bioscience, we all have our own industry strengths. And that requires working with universities, businesses, venture capital firms, financial institutions, and small businesses to advance those clusters. What's really fascinating is in Washington, we have 250 economic development programs, and none of them acknowledge the role of regional economic clusters. And so again, everyone locally is trying to deal with poverty in its new form. Everyone is trying to deal with their industry strengths, and Washington is delivering programs that don't match the way things work on the ground. The second is we say, you know what, Washington is absent when they should be present, and they're actually present when they should be absent. And what we mean by that is on the things that actually really affect local communities, like immigration flows, like the economy, like the desire to reduce their carbon footprint or deal with climate change, which again transcends political boundaries. At least prior to this administration, there was no focus on immigration policy and there was no climate change bill. There's no leadership governing how we're going to tackle these large programs and then giving the tools for localities to help achieve that. But when they do engage, Washington tends to micromanage with a lot of rules and barriers that make creativity at the local level really impossible. Third is we talk about the fact that they hinder the ability to integrate problems And I'm going to elaborate on that in a moment. And then we also talk about the fact that at the end of the day, politics trumps just sound decision-making. And you'll see that in transportation spending. We spend more money on pork projects that are just pet projects versus projects being selected by merit. And so let me just talk a little bit about what we mean by integrated, because I think at the local level, this is exactly how people see issues. So for instance, one of the things the feds do a horrible job on is recognizing that housing, transportation, environment, and school reform are all interrelated. And so this particularly is reared up when we talk about traffic congestion. And oftentimes, the reason we have traffic congestion is not because we don't have enough roads, but it's because we actually put homes, and particularly affordable homes, really far away from where the jobs are. So people have to drive long distances or get into a car to access those jobs. And that's particularly true in Atlanta. Anyone here from Atlanta? No. We did an incredible study in Atlanta where they were trying to figure out when they violated their Air Quality Act why the traffic congestion was so bad. And like many metropolitan areas, they had a favored quarter and a not so favored quarter. And all the growth, all the good jobs were the northern part of Atlanta. And all these workers needed entry-level workers and so forth. All multifamily apartment building was built in the south of the region. And no multifamily apartments were allowed to be built in the northern suburbs. And so people had to drive all the way around the Beltway to get to those jobs. So this is not about more roads. And so, you know, we were going to have to deal with this. A lot of times this is about where we locate affordable housing and how we plan for transportation and housing together to provide more choices, let people travel shorter distances, perhaps even walk to work. And yet, again, policies don't let us do that. And the other way integrated solution doesn't happen, where the feds undermine this, is the fact that at the end of the day, most of our solutions transcend political boundaries. And just like in New York and a lot of places in the Midwest and Northeast, we are highly jurisdictionally politically fragmented. So this is a map of Chicago, and Chicago has over 500 different jurisdictions in the Chicago metropolitan area, 14 counties. When the Mayor Daley decided to put together a Metropolitan Mayor's Caucus, he was like, I'm just going to invite 200 mayors to start because this is too hard. And so how do you do regional decision making with this many jurisdictions? And what we're finding is a lot more places are trying to come together to solve problems. And I had one story in Denver. All the counties, anyone from Denver here? At one point historically, I was told that a lot of the jurisdictions there decided it was time for not just the Denver city to be ones providing affordable housing, but that the suburbs need to take on their share of building affordable housing, particularly because all the growth heading outward. And so all the jurisdictions finally formed a pact that they would each build a percentage of affordable housing in that jurisdiction. It took a long time to get to. And they submitted one regional housing plan to HUD to get funding to do that. And HUD rejected it and said, you know what? Sorry, you have to send it back individually. And at that point, after all that work, the jurisdiction was like, you know, why bother? So this is what I mean about not rewarding jurisdictions to come together to solve problems. And so what we say then in this federalist system is on some things the feds should lead. They need to set the rules for how we distribute transportation funding. We do need them to lead on things that transcend states or multiple states. But within a metropolitan area, we need to push decision-making down and increase an enormous amount of flexibility at the state and local level. And in the end, reward performance and really track performance. So if that's the standard of what it means to be responsive to cities and metropolitan areas, how is this administration doing? And I would say they're doing a really laudable job. And some of this is probably not very visible given how huge healthcare reform has been, how much the focus on the economy has been. Well, I'd say three things. First of all, this administration really does understand the importance of cities and metropolitan areas. Second, they are obsessed with integrated solutions. They are completely focused on that. And third, both in the Stimulus Act as well as the FY10 and FY20 budgets, they're literally trying to do that lead, empower, maximize frame across the four drivers I talked about at the beginning. So let me just walk you through some of this. So the president did create a White House Office of Urban Policy. I would say that's a great start, but the reality is the power of the urban office is only as good as the cabinet secretaries. But first, what we have to say is when he launched that office, this president put out a statement that basically captures what we just talked about. The understanding that metropolitan areas and cities are the vital engines of economic growth, innovation, and opportunity, and that our policies need to meet that reality. And then it has spread beyond the White House Urban Office. And in fact, it's more important for us to hear this from the cabinet secretaries. That means that they're going to deliver their programs through this lens. Obviously, the most natural place to do this is at HUD, and Secretary Donovan has been really, really a leader in all of this, as you can see from this quote. But this is the one that surprised everyone. As Secretary of HUD, head of transportation, an agency that has been historically renowned for putting a lot of transportation spending in rural areas, basically gave a speech in Illinois and said, you know what? It is time for us to put our dollars to where most people and where most of our jobs are, and that's in our metropolitan areas. And he is deliberately and very focused moving in this direction, which is a culture change. So we'll see if it plays out, but at the leadership level, it definitely is. On integrated solutions, which the slides are not in here, but on integrated, what this administration, I think if you read a David Broder column, is that there is unprecedented amount of interagency collaboration on all the things that we've talked about. For the first time, HUD and EPA working together on energy efficient buildings. HUD and Department of Education working together on neighborhood and combining neighborhood policy and school reform policy. A new partnership between HUD, DOT, and EPA to advance sustainable communities. And the list goes on and on. In fact, there's probably more interagency meetings to make sure our policies are totally linked. And it's by so many meetings that people are about drowning. But let me talk, just skim through real quickly the other things that I think are really transformative right now that we should keep an eye on. We talked about the end of the day, if you're going to do economic development, we shouldn't be just building things like industrial park in the middle of nowhere. This is about industry growth and doing it in a regional way. And this president in the FY11 budget basically laid out a sleeper policy, basically a framework that almost all key economic development policies have to be run through a regional industry cluster framework. And six programs in the FY11 budget all acknowledge and reward cluster strategies, EDA, SBA, DOL, labor, and so forth. There is a Secretary Chu has put together an incredible program on an energy innovation hub where seven agencies are joining their dollars to reward a university who's going to come up with the next snazzy energy efficient technology to meet all the energy efficiency goals that we have. Major understanding about regional clusters, major understanding about the need to pool workforce dollars, economic development dollars, research dollars together under one roof. Same thing in education workforce. We've already heard a lot about Race to the Top and Innovation Fund. But again, much more focused on performance-based outcomes on school reform. On transportation, I just maybe would just close with this one, is that huge stuff underway on infrastructure policy in a way that's going to change the way we've done things in the past. First and foremost, we're finally going to do what a lot of our European and Asian competitors do. We're actually going to finally invest in high-speed rail, and we're going to finally invest in the freight and economic hubs and corridors of our country. We have never done this before, and we're going to put together an infrastructure bank in FY 2011 that's going to focus on those investments. already a major down payment on high-speed rail. And, you know, a lot of other things that's going to continue to link transportation into environmental goals. So I think there's a lot of enormous progress made, but we have a lot more work to do. And the one thing I did not talk about is the role of states. And at the end of the day, the administration can put some really powerful programs together to reward the ability to link economic development, transportation, in service of you know, all these different ambitions. But if the states are not with them as partners, that's a problem. And states certainly matter more to the health of cities and metropolitan areas, in fact, than the feds do. I just want to close with this quote, because I think that's really important as we move toward a post-recession environment, is that when we start building a next round of policies around the next economy, how do we double exports over the next 5 years? How do we become the place that is going to be the place for green industries in a way that our European friends will not eat or hide on? What does that mean? We have to come back and remember that metropolitan areas are really going to be the leader to helping us achieve those national objectives. Thank you.
Changing how America transports its people between regional hubs. And my question is, I believe it's going to require a cultural shift, because here in the United States, it's all about, I jump into my car and I'm in the next spot. There's no fun waiting for trains and checking out the train schedule. So how much effort are you putting into sort of getting people to, one, not only buy property in certain specific locations like it is in Atlanta, but then also making them understand that it's okay to live within the city's limits and also utilize these facilities?
You know, I think we care about just providing Americans choice. We're never going to take people out of their cars, and we're never going to say that you cannot buy or live in a gated community in the middle of nowhere in a greenfield. People are going to choose that, and the issue is, we need to make sure we have alternatives. And I think what's really interesting is that, you know, we say there's a lot of developers who argue that at least 25% of the population wants to live in a dense, walkable urban environment with mixed-use development and so forth. But the reality is, if you look at all the development patterns in the country, we deliver 2% of that. And we're just talking about trying to meet 25% of that demand. And so the issue is, what's making it illegal to create more walkable, dense, you know, mixed-use communities where the choice is you could walk or you could bike or not have to take so many trips in a car? On the transportation side, you know, what's interesting is, not all places of the country is going to be ripe for high-speed rail. We're not Europe. We are a very large country with places where there's not a lot of density in between. But what's interesting is, we put out a study earlier this year that just looked at air policy, just air traffic trends, at a time when everyone's complaining about airline delays, the cost of airline tickets, the fact that parts of the country it's impossible to fly to. I'm sure there's a lot of stories like that here in New York, but I did a lot of work in Pennsylvania, and it costs more to fly from Philly to Pittsburgh than it is to fly from Philly to California. And the reason why it is hard to do short, you know, it's getting more cost prohibitive for airlines to cover short lines. What's really interesting is, when we did this analysis, what we found is a couple things. just like our analysis on everything else about metropolitan areas, there's only 25 airports that handle like 75% of the air passenger travel in this country. 25 air hubs. But yet we still, you know, sprinkle airline airport dollars to every single one of them equally. And which is why LaGuardia gets really frustrated, because they actually handle a huge volume of passengers, but they get treated equally to an airport in Topeka, Kansas. And that's the problem with the way we do the peanut butter effect in this country, is we don't recognize the hub and spoke nature and the concentration of the economy in our country. So we're not maximizing our dollars and not investing where we're going to get the biggest economic gains and productivity. But the interesting other thing about that study, when it comes to just transportation patterns and choices, is that it was, I think, the something like, you know, 10 of the busiest airports or air routes in the country are less than 300 miles. The busiest are less than 300 miles. The busiest one being San Francisco to LA. These are the ones that would really benefit from an alternative, loosen up those congested airlines, you know, and allow them to redistribute and choose, you know, provide source, coverage in other places. So I think that this is the problem, is we're not, you know, it is going to be a culture change, but we're not going to get culture change if we don't give people that product to test, you know, a change in consumer behavior. Other questions? Yes.
Good afternoon. My name is Jack Lowe, and I'm a second-year CEPA student. And I'm somewhat confused when you're talking about high-speed rail, which I understand, you know, from city to city, but then it seemed like it's being conflated with local transportation problems, and you didn't really seem to address light rail, which would be the solution to that. Would you kind of elaborate on those?
Yeah, and you're right. High-speed rail is, you know, between metropolitan areas, multi-state, very different from, yes, dealing with traffic congestion within a metropolitan area. This is the place where it's getting harder. There's certainly more money that this administration has put towards transit funding, particularly at a time when there's a lot more demand for building light rail. And it's really interesting that all the new light rail systems that are being built are out in the West and the South. But what's interesting is one of the things that we've been pushing for in the transportation reauthorization bill, not just us but a bunch of other people, is, you know what, if the feds are going to lead on high-speed rail, lead on providing transportation options that are multi-metro or between metros, what does it mean to empower transportation decision-making at the metropolitan level? And one of the ways we would get to it is what we would say called being modally agnostic. And what does it mean to be modally agnostic? Right now, we deliver transportation money on the mode. And basically, we're going to give you a highway pot of money, a bridge pot of money, a transit pot of money, a sidewalk money, and bike lane money. And you can't flex in between. And, you know, what we tend to give people is we give you a lot of highway money and a lot of road money. And yet, if Denver said, our biggest transportation priority right now is to build out our light rail system, we don't give them the flexibility to say, let's move this pots of money around. And one of the things that we're arguing for to get to transit options, or if you want to build light rail, is, and we talk about choice, is why not give metropolitan areas one pot of money and let them choose, depending on where they are in their trajectory, what kind of transportation investments they want to make. But it's really funny. You know, you hear that the perverse incentives our system creates, that when there is traffic congestion, people end up coming up with a road solution because that's where the money is. So they'll just widen the road. And so we need to break that system of driving, really skewing decision making because of the way we deliver our pots of money. So yes, advocates are really pushing for increased spending in transit, and that's happening, but we need to get to go in the next level, which is to break down these pots.
you talk a little bit about how Congress has helped or impeded the urban agenda?
Yeah. I'm probably a little bit more quiet about Congress because Congress is harder. And when people get frustrated about the partisan nature and the gridlock in Washington, a lot of it is because how hard it is to work through Congress. I think I'll say first and foremost, Congress has definitely been a partner with the administration on a couple things. And they obviously embraced the stimulus package. They actually have had hearings between, so just like we've been saying about how the Obama administration is working between agencies to deliver integrated comprehensive solutions, we're finally starting to see the EPA committee and the Housing Committee doing joint hearings, like on sustainability. So they're trying to break down their committee structures in the way the administration is. But I think it's hard. I would say the biggest barrier with Congress is the same biggest barrier we have with state legislatures, which is they still tend to be very rural-oriented. And they still, not only that, they still love bringing the money home to their districts. And we see this when we do work at states. So when we want to empower metro areas, there's always a perverse reaction to make sure that we sprinkle money equally between every single state and between every single jurisdiction because of the way our legislature is set up. And this is why governors have a hard time oftentimes with their state legislature, is that the force of, you know, leveraging your assets runs against the counter to districts' politics.
Thank you for coming out today. We'd like to give you this super
mug. Thank you very much.
And our current public policy.
Oh, great.
Position.
Thank you very much. Thank you.